First thing, all of us got a cryptic email that there's some sort of announcement at 10:15 tomorrow morning. So let's. I learned that the announcement is not going to take very long, and that in particular they'd like all the students to go. So let's postpone class tomorrow morning by like 5 or 10 minutes or however long the announcement takes, so we can all go and unravel the mystery. Mysterious announcement. I don't know what the mysterious announcement is either. Let's start analyzing. I'm going to spend some lectures, maybe even the rest of the lectures, I'm not sure, talking about the physics of perturbations. There are three, roughly the history that I want to describe can be divided into three epochs. There's inflation. Of course, inflation's not the only theory of the early universe, and I'm actually also going to restrict scope to the simplest model of inflation, single field Sorel. During inflation, the field content will be simple. There's just the degrees of freedom of the metric, which will get perturbations, and some scalar field phi. The physics is the physics of QFT in an expanding spacetime. So we'll analyze that setup, and the output of that analysis will be the statement that inflation generates adiabatic Gaussian initial conditions with a power law spectrum. Generically, what you get is a constant, close to scale invariant, a constant times over 3 minus epsilon, where epsilon is some small free parameter. That'll be the input to another stage of the universe where the physics is different, what I'll call the CMB epoch, which is the time between the hot Big Bang, or let's say radiation domination, deep in radiation domination, until the redshift of formation of the CMB, which is at a redshift of around 1,000. In this epoch, the field content is really complicated, and there's just a lot of messiness associated to the fact that the equations have so many degrees of freedom in them. We'll have the degrees of freedom of the metric, and then the stress energy tensors of every species in the universe. So there'll be a stress energy tensor for the baryons, which keeps track of the density fluctuations, the velocity, the bulk velocity, the pressure, and so on. Stress energy tensor for the cold dark matter, for the photons, and for neutrinos. Those are the species in the standard model. Each one of these guys is a symmetric tensor in four dimensions with 10 degrees of freedom, so there's like 50 variables here. The physics is also kind of complicated, so it's just linear perturbation theory. Conceptually, we're just describing the propagation of sound waves in a plasma, but one with sort of 50 degrees of freedom. It's also going to be linear perturbation theory in GR, like general relativistic degrees of freedom are important, which is going to make things complicated. We'll go from there. I ran out of vertical space, so I'll put the arrow this way, to the late universe, which for a theoretical physicist, Blade might mean anything after a redshift of 1,000. Where the field content here, many of these degrees of freedom, even though they're there in principle, are pretty negligible in practice. In the sort of minimal cosmological standard model, you really, to a good approximation, only need to keep track of the density of the matter field, which is the sum of, when I write an M subscript, I always mean the sum of baryonic and cold dark matter contributions, and the bulk velocity of the matter field. And the physics is nonlinear. Simple to write down, but analytic calculations have limited scope because if you have a nonlinear differential equation. In this case, a big complicated nonlinear partial differential equation. You won't be able to solve it analytically to really do things completely. You need to rely on numerical simulations. But there are a lot of interesting statements that we can make with analytic tools in this regime. Okay. Now, before, I'm going to talk about sort of all three of these epochs and how you get from one to the other. And I want to do so in a sort of a systematic way where I use as much common machinery in the three epochs as possible. And so I'm going to start, this will take a lecture or two, by just setting up some machinery. I'm going to just talk about how you analyze a general perturbation of an FRW spacetime. And we'll derive some common notation and formulas like the form of Einstein's equations that apply in all three regimes. Okay, so first let me just introduce some notation for describing a general perturbation of an FRW metric. So the unperturbed metric, of course, is this. And when I perturb it, and these lines are really definitions. So there'll be some perturbation to G00, which I'll define to be A with this factor of -2, which is convenient. So this defines A, which is 1 degree of freedom. I'll define G0i to be, I'm indicating explicitly which fields are functions of time and alone and which functions are functions of space and time. So there's going to be a vector bi with 3 degrees of freedom. And then some perturbation hij with 6 degrees of freedom. And the total number of degrees of freedom is 10, as you'd expect for a symmetric tensor and for space-time dimensions. So these are just definitions. Let me warn you that for some reason, so this is kind of a messy subject. I'm going to develop sort of a big encyclopedia of equations. The notation used in different references is not standardized. So you'll find some references might define like this A to be with an extra minus sign or some other letter. So just be a little careful. I tried to pick a set of conventions which is sort of most typical in the literature, and that might just be compounding the problem because that really just introduces an independent set of conventions, and everyone's trying to do this. But I'll stick with some unified set of conventions during the lectures. Now an important thing is that all calculations will be to first order in the at least for now. First order in the fluctuations. A, B, and H, I, J. But you know, in all orders and you know, the other things like parameter vectors of the scale factor H and so on. Okay. So I'm going to calculate, the first thing I'm going to calculate is the inverse metric. So G mu nu, G upper mu nu. Now, what GR tells me to do is to just write down a 4x4 matrix, unpack the G lower mu nu into a 4x4 matrix and invert. Let me write that this way. I've organized it as the unperturbed FRW term, which is trivial to invert because it's diagonal, plus a perturbation that I just want to keep to first order. Here's a trick. In general, by the way, when I go through calculations in lecture, I feel like that's a useful thing to do when the calculation illustrates some sort of trick that's useful in a more general context. So here there's kind of a useful trick, which is that if I want to invert the sum of two matrices, one of which I already know how to invert, and the other is a small perturbation, then there's a general formula for that, which is a good, useful thing to know. So let me phrase this as sort of a real-time question. So if A and B are two variables which commute, then if I had the expression A plus B to the minus 1, it would have this series expansion with alternating signs. Does anyone happen to know offhand, maybe you know because this comes up a lot, what this expression still applies if A and B don't commute? It's ambiguous, right? The ordering here is now ambiguous. So does anyone know what ordering to use here if A and B don't commute? Say in this first subleading term. This is a super useful thing to know. Like in GR, it comes up a lot, or just other contexts where you're perturbing something. So the answer is you just sort of interleave the A and the Bs. If you forget that, you can derive it. So if the if A were the identity matrix, then there would be no ambiguity, of course. I can reduce to that case by just pulling out A, pulling this 1 plus AB, A inverse B, sorry, to the minus 1. And now when I invert, I have to switch the order. Now I'm in the unambiguous case, so I can just, I get the alternating signs. And then multiplying the A inverse back through, you get the result shown. Applying that formula. To invert that matrix in brackets, we get the following chain.
And
from here, it's trivial.
Straightforward to just multiply out the matrices, so I won't go through it. Maybe I'll put like a dot, dot, dot to indicate that some straightforward steps have been skipped to get the form of the inverse matrix.
So I'm going to be building up a big like encyclopedia of formulas. Like here's the next entry in the encyclopedia, the form of the inverse matrix. I will, because there are so many formulas and I don't have tech notes, what I will do is start updating like a formula sheet, not as systematic as notes, but actual notes, but something that just has all the key formulas, which I'll put on the wiki, but I haven't quite done it yet.
Sorry, do you erase the spatial index with the
Kronecker delta? Yeah, great question. That is just the thing that I was gonna say next. There is the notation here. My notation is that Roman indices on three tensors like hij are raised and lowered with delta ij. So. In fact, I'll be kind of sloppy about the placement of those indices. So there's kind of a notational pitfall here that I want to stress, which is that you might be tempted to take, there's a type of error you can make. Let me illustrate it like this. You might be tempted to take a formula like this, g lower ij. Plus 2hij. And say, well, if this formula is true, then surely it's still true if I raise the, let's put the arrow in quotes because it's not really, really correct. Surely it's also true if I raise the indices on both sides, right? that's not correct. As you can see, the correct expression, oh, I forgot the minus sign. Well, actually, I guess you would get that wrong too. The correct expression has a minus sign here, and it also has the minus 2 in the exponent. So you have to keep track of which, when you see a formula like this, you have to keep track of which objects are 4 tensors and which objects are 3 tensors. So since G is a 4 tensor, then the indices are raised and lowered with the 4 metric. And since H is a 3 tensor, they're raised and lowered with delta ij. In fact, it doesn't really even matter where you put them. I would also say it's correct to put them here. If I fixed it up. It just looks weird, so I tend to place them wherever I think looks the least weird in the formula, just cosmetic. So that's a little notational pitfall. All right. The next thing I want to calculate, the next entry in the encyclopedia, is the effect of gauge transformation on the metric. A gauge transformation in general relativity is just a change of coordinates. So one thing that's going to happen, since we're talking about perturbations in an FRW spacetime, there's a gauge ambiguity that arises. So you might imagine that it's a well-defined thing to say that there's some non-zero fluctuation delta rho in the density of the universe, say. But in an unperturbed FRW spacetime, rho evolves with time. It has different values on different time slices. And so if I just come along and choose different coordinates, then in those coordinates, rho will appear to have a perturbation. Likewise, it's generally true that for a general perturbation of an FRW spacetime, you can always choose coordinates so that there's no fluctuation in rho, say. You just choose your time coordinate, you just choose your surfaces of constant time to be the same as surfaces of constant rho. In other words, you just let the density field itself be the time coordinate of the universe. Now what will happen is that you'll shift, when you gauge away, so to speak, the fluctuation in rho, you'll introduce fluctuation somewhere else, like into some component of the metric tensor, say. But it does sort of raise the question of, if you have a given perturbation written down, even whether it's a real perturbation or just a gauge artifact, if you just sort of applied a coordinate transformation to an unperturbed universe. So we're going to want a sort of a systematic notation for keeping track, for going from one coordinate system to another, and keeping track of the effects of a gauge transformation. Now, a gauge transformation is a change of coordinates. And since some new set of coordinates, and since I'm only interested in gauge transformations that connect small perturbations of the FRW spacetime, I'm only going to consider coordinate changes which are also small. In other words, the gauge transformations that I consider will have the same order in perturbation theory as the fluctuations themselves. So since I'm doing everything to first order, here my notation for gauge transformations will be the following. A gauge transformation to first order is just a shift by some small vector field epsilon, which is first order in perturbation theory, where epsilon mu is first order in perturbation theory. All right. So I'm going to use a little notation for epsilon that's like similar to the, time space splitting that I'm introducing in other first order quantities. Let me write the general first order gauge transformation as a scalar alpha, which is reparameterizing time. That's a function of x and t. And a three vector field beta. So now I have to compute the following. What happens if I apply an infinitesimal gauge transformation alpha comma beta I to the metric G, what's the new metric? That'll look like, in these variables, some shift in the value of A, B, I, and H, I, J that arises as a result of applying the gauge transformation. So any suggestions on how to set up or how to do this GR calculation?
You get the
legal relation. What a great answer. That's absolutely right.
I mean, you put in the infinitesimal transformation, you can expand it, and you see it's the legal relation.
That's right. So there is a type of derivative in GR. By the way, one general comment is that I'm not quite sure what things in GR that you guys have or have not seen. So I'm going to ask a lot of questions like this, because I know you took a GR class, but it was only 3 weeks long. So that's right. There is a GR concept called the Lie derivative. And so the general statement is, let's let this be any tensor with, say, k upper indices and l lower indices. The general statement is that tensor transforms as the components of the tensor transform as, with the usual sign convention for the Lie derivative, a minus sign. Where the definition of the Lie derivative written out in components is that if epsilon is a vector field and I apply the Lie derivative to T, then I get, let's see, so first off there's a formula that looks like epsilon dot partial derivative. Then there are a bunch of terms where I move a mu into the epsilon and put a lambda in its place. And then there are a bunch of terms. The upper indices get a minus sign. And then there are a bunch of terms where I move a lower index over here. It's the Lie derivative. So you might compare this formula to the covariant derivative. The covariant derivative with respect to the same vector field look like this. The first term is the same. Then epsilon tends to Christoffel sum. Lambda goes here. I have a rho that goes here. Mu I is here. Okay. So the formula looks similar, but there are some important differences. One thing that you'll notice is that in the covariant derivative, epsilon always appears undifferentiated, whereas the Lie derivative appears differentiated. That's because the Lie derivative is sort of a involves some sort of global flow around the point where it's evaluated. You're making some sort of global change of coordinates and looking at how the tensor responds. Whereas in the covariant derivative is really defined in a different way, where you just need to know a vector, and then you can differentiate the tensor field in that direction. So the Lie derivative in that sense is like maybe, doesn't correspond as directly to your intuition about what a derivative is, and so it doesn't arise as often in GR. It's really only arises in this specific situation where you're doing a gauge transformation. It does have the property that it doesn't require a metric. If you look at the placement of the indices here, I didn't raise or lower anything. So it's defined even if there's no metric. And in fact, we're going to apply it to the metric to see how it responds to the gauge transformation. What would you get if you applied the covariant derivative to the metric? Yeah, that's right. That's one of the defining conditions for the Liebig-Chivita connection, is that the
covariant derivative is 0. Okay. So let's calculate. All right, so now we just apply the Lie derivative to the components of the metric. So just to do an example, to show that there's no, show how this works, if I apply the Lie derivative to, say, the I0 component of the metric, I get this. Now, I'm only interested in knowing the Lie derivative to first order in the fluctuations. I'm just computing everything to first order. And since epsilon is already a first order quantity, then a lot of terms drop out here. In fact, you could, a nice way to say it is that you can apply the Lie derivative to the unperturbed FRW spacetime. So the first term, for example, is 0, because GI0 is equal to 0. And, unperturbed FRW. And the other terms, there's a non-zero term here that where the lambda index is 0. So g bar 0, 0 is minus 1. Oh, I have a sign error, don't I? No, that's sorry. This is the right sign. It's plus sign for lower density. OK. And there's a non-zero element here where lambda is space-like, and you get an a squared p delta ij. Sorry, a squared delta ij. Okay. So let's write the result as minus partial I alpha plus beta j dot a squared delta ij. I always use over dots for derivatives with respect to proper time. Proper time t. Some authors use derivatives with respect to conformal time tau. Okay. So this shows that under an infinitesimal gauge transformation, the shift that you get in g lower I0 is minus Lie derivative or partial I alpha is a squared theta I dot. And writing gi0 equals minus a bi, we get a transformation law for b. The other components, the transformation law for the other components can be worked out similarly. The transformation law for A is minus alpha dot. The transformation law for H is minus H delta ij alpha minus 1/2 partial I beta j partial j. Where big H is the Hubble parameter of the unperturbed FRW. Okay. Now, I'll put a box here because these formulas will be in the encyclopedia of things that we'll use a lot later. Uh, All right, so basically what I've done so far is just introduce a bunch of notation for describing perturbations of the metric tensor and gauge transformations. Now I'm going to do the same for the stress energy tensor. So here are the variables that I want to use to describe a perturbation of the stress energy tensor T mu nu. So unperturbed looks like this. Perturbed, I'm going to use this weird looking parameterization. So T upper 0, 0. Rho bar times 1 minus 2a plus delta rho. So this is defining delta rho. T0i minus a inverse p bar. I'm going to put bars just to emphasize that these are unperturbed. P bar means the unperturbed pressure. Delta. So this is defining a three vector VI. Delta P, delta IJ, say it's minus 2 P bar pi IJ, where this equation is defining a scalar delta P and a traceless symmetric tensor pi ij. So strictly speaking, this is a definition. This is just matching up the 10 components of the general perturbation of T mu nu with one scalar, the three components of a vector, one more scalar, and five components of a traceless symmetric tensor for 10 degrees of freedom and all. Of course, there's something to explain here, which is why this weird definition makes sense. I mean, wouldn't it have been simpler if I had left the 2a off here and just taken T00 to be rho bar plus delta rho, let that define delta rho? And so as you might imagine, so the thing to explain is why this definition makes physical sense. As you have guessed from the notation, the reason this is useful is because this quantity delta rho corresponds most closely to your intuition about of what a density fluctuation should be. Likewise for this velocity, this pressure perturbation. And this pi ij is supposed to be an anisotropic part, a quadrupolar part in a distribution of particle velocities. This is sometimes called the anisotropic stress. So I'm going to explain why this definition makes sense. And this also give me a chance to talk about perfect fluids. So let me give sort of an informal definition of a perfect fluid. A fluid is perfect at a point x0 in spacetime. This is a definition that makes sense independently point by point. If its stress energy tensor
is isotropic in its restraint. Now, what restraint means is the following. So if I just ignore the fluid, something that's generally true about space-time, spaces with metrics, is that there will be a local coordinate system near x naught where the metric looks like Minkowski. So I can always choose at any point some coordinate system where the metric looks like this. No a squared's on the diagonal. I've just chosen coordinates so that the space coordinates are physical distance at the time t naught. So this is something that you may have proved in your GR class. Just out of curiosity, let me ask you guys this question. Is it also possible to choose the coordinate system so that the derivatives of g mu nu, so that every partial derivative of g mu nu vanishes? Of course, if you could find coordinates so that this was true everywhere, then you know the whole space-time would be, the whole geometry would be trivial. But so at some order in derivatives, you must be forced to introduce something that differs from Minkowski. But let's think about what order that happens in. I don't think that this is obvious, but the answer is yes. You can choose so-called normal coordinates where this is true. And if you want some sort of cartoon intuition for why, if you just imagine, you know, the first derivatives of the metric are what appear in the connection. So you might imagine that if I start in normal coordinates and then extend the coordinate system just by following geodesics, you know, I follow the coordinates that I assign to a particular point are just assigned geometrically by drawing a geodesic to that point. And then based on the distance that I had to travel along the geodesic and the angle of the tangent vector that I started out on, I assign coordinates. That's how it works. That's basically how the construction works. But the actual details are a little complicated. Now, what about two? I'll give you a hint and say that the answer is no. It's not generally possible for an arbitrary metric to choose coordinates so that the second derivatives of the metric tensor vanish. But does anyone see a reason offhand why this has to be true?
The guy shows up in the curvature tensor, and there is a tensor, unlike the connection.
That is a perfect answer. That's right. So second derivatives appear in the, if every first and second derivative were zero, it would follow that the whole curvature tensor is zero. This would imply that the entire Riemann curvature tensor is zero. And that is a tensor. That has to, you know, if it's zero in one coordinate system, it has to be zero in every coordinate system. So this is some, you know, geometric thing that you can't just gauge away. There's also a theorem, by the way, that if the curvature vanishes everywhere in a whole region, if I can draw, you know, a little blob here and the curvature is zero everywhere, then it is possible to choose a coordinate system so that the entire metric is Minkowski over the blob. So the curvature is sort of like the only obstruction to making the metric look Minkowski. It's a very, totally non-obvious statement, but just mentioning it for fun. All right, so the rest frame of the fluid actually means, I'm going to erase this little tangent. So the rest frame of the fluid means two things. So first, I can choose coordinates where the metric looks Minkowski. And then I still have freedom in my coordinate choice, because this Minkowski metric has symmetries. I can rotate and boost. And in particular, the boosts let me set the bulk velocity of the fluid to zero. So it's also true that I can choose my coordinates so that the four velocity of the fluid is equal to this. The formal definition of a perfect fluid, or one formal definition, is that the fluid is perfect if, in the frame defined by these conditions, the stress energy of the fluid. I'm going to put a subscript F here to emphasize that this is just the stress energy of one fluid, and the universe might be full of multiple fluids. The total stress energy of the universe might be something different. Is equal to, I guess I should put the F here as well. Is equal to rho F VF. Okay. Now what I would like to do, this definition of a perfect fluid is not really what you want for doing calculations, because it doesn't tell you, doesn't give you a formula for the stress energy tensor in some other coordinate system, for example, the global coordinate system of the, you know, the perturbed FRLB spacetime. So the next thing that I'm going to calculate is a formula for T mu nu that applies in an arbitrary coordinate system. Does anyone have a suggestion for how I might? That kind of seems like it, you know, it's going to require some sort of a magic trick. Anyone have a suggestion for what I might do? What's that, sorry?
Like T00 is basically T mu nu, V mu, V nu. And at the same time, it has to be rho. And so you can say that it's going to be like V mu, V nu times rho, which is the like a tensor way to construct something which has only one component here and everything else is zero. And then you can do that for the pressure as well.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So that's exactly the right idea. So a really powerful idea in GR is a really powerful calculational idea, is the principle that if you have a equation and identity between two tensors that is true in one coordinate system, that it's true in every coordinate system. So what I'd like to do, now nothing that I've written down here is an identity between tensors, but if I get a little creative, then I can find one. So the tensor identity that is true in the rest frame is that, so let's see, so to get the p's on the diagonal, I need to take rho f plus pf g mu nu. Then that gives me a minus rho here, a minus p here, whereas I wanted, I'm actually already writing this down wrong. To get the p's on the diagonal, I start with p fluid g mu nu. And then that's going to give me a minus p here, whereas I want rho. So to fix that, I need to put in rho plus p times, let's call the forward velocity u mu. So I converted this to a tensor equation. And that means that I get to use it in the other frame. So this is a better definition of a perfect fluid. A fluid is perfect if its stress energy tensor has this form. Where p and rho are scalars, and u is a four-vector satisfying u dot u equals minus 1. So in particular, I can use this formula to see what a perfect fluid would look like in my perturbed FRW spacetime. Before I compute T mu nu, I actually have to do a little calculation for U mu. U mu has to look like this. So the With the index raised, the spatial part should look like a to the minus 1 vi, where v has units of physical distance per proper time. And this is actually really just a definition. I'm just defining vi to be whatever is in the spatial part here. But then u0 is constrained by this condition. And if I write that out, I have, I'm not free to assign that. The 0, 0 part of this equation gives me a minus 1, minus 2a here. The other parts you can see are going to be 0, like the ij part is, it's second order in perturbation theory, because the velocity v is first order in perturbation theory. In an unperturbed FRW spacetime, everything is at rest. So I'm only considering perturbations that move non-relativistically whose velocities are small. The 0i component is 0 because g0i is first order, and I have one 0th order thing and one first order thing here for a total of second order. So to first order in perturbation theory, if I put this over on the other side and take the square root, u0 must be 1 minus a. So if I plug that in, I'm almost out of time. So if I plug this in, plug umu in here and plug in the previous expression for g with two upper indices, then it's straightforward to get at all the components of the stress energy of a perfect fluid in that space-time. You end up getting, I'll just summarize the answer. Now, if you compare this expression, so just to summarize, a perfect fluid in this a stress energy tensor in this perturbed FRW spacetime is the stress energy of a perfect fluid. If it has this functional form, where you're free to choose the rho f, the pf, and the velocity v, but that's a constrained form because that's five numbers in a 10 parameter object. Now, if you compare this formula with the definition that I wrote down here, you'll see that the definition is constructed so that for a perfect fluid, the delta rho here is just the difference between the rho f that you would assign to the fluid and the mean rho. Likewise for p, the velocity v is the velocity of the perfect fluid. These quantities as defined will correspond to something physically meaningful, and it's will make a lot of formulas simpler later if we use these definitions. Pi, this tensor pi, measures the deviation, the imperfection in a fluid. It's the deviation of its stress energy from the perfect fluid form. I have one more page on this general setup, but I'll have to do it next time.